Hello again. I'm recording this at the beginning of 2024. So if you are listening to this as it's going out, not quite live, but the first release of the recording, Happy New Year. And with a new year, hopefully you've got some new adventures planned, or if not at the final planning stage, at least things that you're thinking about doing, which will give you the opportunity to maybe see some wildlife, maybe go somewhere you've never been before, hopefully experience some positive things that you've never experienced before either. So with that in mind, what I thought I would do is review some of the things to bear in mind when you're planning your photography shoot. So now, if you've already decided where you're going, that's fine. And if you've listened to me talk about this before, or you've been on the webinars, obviously you'll know that research is something that I put a lot of emphasis and effort into when I go. So I make sure that I know what to expect when I go somewhere. If there are particular animals I want to see, I just make sure I'm actually there at the right time. So an example I often give is humpback whales off the coast of Sydney, which is a fantastic sight to see these amazing animals going past a big city like that. But you really got to do it between the end of May and the end of November, because that's when they're there. If you try go in the middle of March and hope to see humpback whales off the coast of Sydney, you're going to be disappointed. So do all of the research. Maybe you've already done that. But be clear about when those animals are likely to be around, because some animals are there all year round and obviously others aren't. So you need to do that. The next thing in the planning is to understand the behavior that you're likely to see and when you're likely to see it. So, you know, maybe you're hoping for that great shot of a predator in Africa making a kill. And as much as nature can be very cruel and can be quite hard to witness some of that, if you're seeing a young animal being killed by a predator. On the other hand, just from a purely photographic perspective, they can be quite satisfying shots to take because they're not something that everybody sees. So there's always a trade-off there. You might hate the thought of seeing something being killed, but you know that's the reality of nature photography and wildlife photography in particular. So if that's what you're hoping for, though, what time of day is that likely to happen? Because if you're in a country that's very hot, the chances are that most of the hunting goes on during the cooler hours. So around dawn, around dusk, or even at night. And clearly that presents more problems for your photography because you're now dealing with low light levels. You can't realistically use flash when you're doing wildlife. I mean, that is not an option for all sorts of reasons. You know, primarily you want to be there as an observer and not interfere with the animals. And I would imagine if I was a predator and about to spring on a prey animal and somebody lights everything up with a flash gun, I'd be pretty cross about that. So, and I think that comes back to another aspect of photography. And there's a little phrase that I really like, and it's to take only photographs and leave only footprints. And that, for me, sums up ethical wildlife photography. We're there to observe. We're there to watch the animals doing what they would do if we weren't there. And I think it's true that when you are watching something going on, to some extent, you're going to be interfering with what's going on. And so our job as wildlife photographers is to minimize our impact and the difference we're making to those animals, because they are likely to be aware of us. Some of them, at least, are going to be aware of us, and that will change their behavior to some extent. So bear that in mind. So if you are hoping for a shot, but it's likely to happen at times when they're not, the lighting conditions, let's say, or other conditions aren't ideal, do what you can to prepare for that. And I mean, I've been lucky enough to get a cheetah taking down a young impala, and that was during the day. And you will get those opportunities. They do come up from time to time. In India, I was there when a tiger killed another small antelope, but it actually happened in the woods. And all I saw was the tiger coming across a small clearing with the prey in its mouth and basically walking across with other of these antelope just watching on. So you never know what you're going to get. And the thing, again, is to be ready for whatever might present itself as an opportunity. So do understand when you're most likely to see the kind of behaviours that you're hoping to see. If they are at times or in situations where they're likely to be difficult photographically, lighting would be the key one, but it might also be a question of having to really use a fast shutter speed, and that also has implications on your ISO, your aperture, you know, all of that stuff. So have a think through of how that's likely to impact what you're doing and plan accordingly. So it may be that you just have to shoot at a higher ISO and maybe do some cleaning up later, maybe use a package to reduce the amount of noise in the shot. That might be a possibility, depending on what you're going to do with that photograph. And that's another thing, you know, what do you want to have at the end of this trip? Do you want to do a photo book? Do you want to just pull out one or two photographs and have them as images on a wall? Do you want to sell them? So again, what you're going to use them for as a final result, if you like, when you're maybe a year from now looking back on that trip, how are you going to be looking back on it? Is it just social media? Is it Instagram? Are you going to do something more with it? I love the idea of photo books personally. I always used to put albums together when I was photographing using film. And frankly, that was quite an expensive process and quite time consuming. Whereas these days, there are some very good online Photoshop packages that you can use where you can just set a photo book up. I might have just said Photoshop then. I meant photo book. but yeah, you can set the book up and really play around with it and tell the story of the trip. So when you're going on the trip, if that's what you're planning to do, to put a photo book together at the end of the trip, then think about linking photos. And what I mean by that is share more of the experience than just your sort of favorite animal pictures from it. How about if you're camping or glamping or doing something else, what it's like, what is it first thing in the morning? Think about some sunrise photographs just to maybe introduce a day, sunset photographs, what else is around? Get creative. What's your field of view like? Do you want to get down low, create a more unusual shot? If you're in a vehicle, do maybe a series of shots of the animal, which might be a close-up, it might be a wider shot so you can see where they are. Maybe even other vehicles around if you're at one of these wildlife parks where there's a lot of safari vehicles around with people in them. Maybe do that as a wide shot. It creates context and it tells the story, and it's a more complete story than if you just concentrate on, you know, that really nice close-up you got of a cheetah's face, let's say, or whatever it might be. So have a think about that as well. And by doing that, that will determine how big your files need to be and maybe how many of them. So if you're going for very big prints, then ideally you want to be shooting with the maximum image size that your camera will support. But don't forget, there's always a trade-off, because it means you can keep fewer of them on the memory card that you have in the camera. I'm assuming digital camera here. And also it might affect how the camera operates. So I use a Canon EOS 5D, and that has, I'm using the DS, so that has a very large, the maximum image size is very large, and that's what I use. And I shoot RAW, never shoot JPEG, always shoot RAW. And the downside to that is it takes a finite time for the camera to write what it's seeing onto the memory card. And that limits my burst. So I can do a burst of 1 to 2 seconds, and then the camera just has to pause for a moment to finish writing everything to the card, and then it will start again. But if you do want to do a longer sequence, a longer burst, and certainly if you're in a situation where you're on land and an animal, a predator is chasing down a prey animal, excuse me, that's likely to require short bursts, series of short bursts, and you might find that the critical moment, your camera's stopped and having a wheeze and just finishing off writing to the memory card before it can pick up again. So know your camera, that's absolutely fundamental, but know what it can do under those more extreme situations. And maybe you need to shoot at a slightly smaller file size. So most cameras will give you the option of file size so that you don't have to shoot huge files all the time. And if you're in that situation that the camera does tend to run out of speed a little bit when you're at sort of maximum size, maximum burst, then my suggestion would be just to experiment a little bit. Look at the file size that you're creating on the camera and can you get away with using a smaller file size, which hopefully overcomes the issue with doing a longer burst. And what does that give you in terms of the raw file that you're then going to be working with to create a photo book or something to put on the wall or whatever it might be? Now, if you're only using them for social media, it won't matter because you're going to convert it to a JPEG anyway. And for social media, you can get away with quite small original files. To an extent, the same applies to a photo book. Again, always go with RAW though, and look at the documentation or the hints that the photo book manufacturer gives you about what format it needs to be in, the maximum minimum sizes. And again, if you've got let's say a photo book that's around A4 size, so kind of a normal size, or maybe a square, let's say 11 by 11 inches for those of you who use inches, something like that. It's kind of a nice size book. It's not too big, but it's a nice size to look at the photographs. So if you're doing a full page, you want to make sure you've got enough resolution in the original image to get a decent image on the page. And certainly some of them. Now, I use Blurb for some work. My experience with Blurb is that they are good quality. What you get is a nice quality photo book. They're a little more expensive than some others. So that's my experience. It's not a recommendation particularly, because you might have access to somebody who's much better. But one of the things I like about them is they have downloadable software that you can put on your computer, on your laptop, and then use that to just put the book together. So you can just set up the format of the book, how big you want the photographs to be. You can put in text. You can put in multiple images on one page. You can have an image over two pages. Lots of flexibility. And one of the nice things about that software is that it warns you if you're making the image too big based on the file size that you've given them to work with. So if the resolution is not high enough on that particular image to do, let's say, a double page spread, it will warn you. So that's something that I do recommend. So how are you going to use final image or the final images when you get back from your trip? So have a think about that, because obviously, as I've explained, that will have an impact on what you're shooting. The link images as well. I like that idea because it does break things up a bit. And if you're going with friends, or even if you're just with a group of people, it's nice to have a group shot or maybe a shot of your guide or you with your guide, whoever it might be, just to put that sort of, it makes it more personal, I think. And particularly in a book, you've got the space to do that and you can tell more of the story, the ups and downs of the trip, maybe the unexpected things that happened. Maybe unexpected encounters with animals or whatever it might be. So what you do with that is obviously up to you, but do have some fun with it. Even photographs of you leaving home, if you really want to start from there, jumping in the car or the taxi or whatever it is to go and catch a flight or however you're getting to your destination. So have a think about that and have fun with it, because I think when you do that, it's more engaging for people. It's one thing to look at a book or a series of photographs of animals, and that's nice enough. But if you can mix in some more personal stuff, it tells more of the story and it does make it more personal, and particularly for people who know you. I think it's more enjoyable because they see you in that environment. And it's kind of fun looking back, maybe, years from now, looking back on it and, you've got those pictures of you doing that trip, and it might be hopefully it's a trip you look back on very fondly in years to come, and you've captured a lot more of it than just having the animal photos. So there you go on that one. Now, I did mention, though, in your camera, to me, this is absolutely vital. This is probably the most important thing after, I mean, do your planning and you can get away with, I mean, you could go do a safari shoot with a smartphone and a pair of binoculars and you can get probably some nice results if you practice. But knowing your gear is really important, and do understand all the basics, particularly the exposure triangle, because that gives you your depth of field. You can handle low light. You can handle very bright light situations. You can control all of the creative elements, the creative aspects of your photographs. So absolutely know that. And if you're not familiar enough with your camera, or you don't feel comfortable enough, or you look at a photograph and you can't work out how somebody got that particular result, I definitely recommend doing a photo course. If it's just a refresher, if you've maybe haven't used your camera for a while, do something like a 14-day challenge. So all of these you can get from my website, and as well as other places. There are many sources of those sort of ideas, or maybe a different kind of photo challenge. But doing a photo challenge gets you to perhaps shoot in ways you wouldn't normally shoot, or you've forgotten how to shoot, and it just gets you back into that way of thinking, and it just rebuilds that familiarity with the camera. And then when you are away on your trip, you might get an inspiration for a photograph using a technique that you wouldn't normally use, but because you practiced it, you're able to do it. So that, I think, is probably the most important thing to practice before you go away, to just get really comfortable with your camera. If you've got older gear or you use it in environments that are quite dirty, I like to get my gear serviced at least once a year. So that would be the camera body and also the lenses. So for me, I used to, when I was doing a lot of whale photography, I would inevitably get some spray on the camera. And because obviously seawater is very salty, I just like to have everything that I was using on the boat cleaned up at least once a year to make sure there was no rust getting in anywhere or anything that might impact the operation of the camera and the lens. Also, there's that danger of bumping the lens against something, definitely if you're moving around on a boat. So my recommendation is to always have your lens hood on the camera, on the lens. It doesn't matter, it could be middle of the night, it doesn't matter. But if you're somewhere where you might accidentally bump the lens against something hard, like the side of a vehicle or on a boat, the lens hood will absorb a lot of that energy. So you're less likely to damage the lens. Now, that obviously the extreme of that is cracking the glass or doing something nasty like that. But the kind of minor things that can happen might just bump the alignment of the lens elements within the lens. So this is another reason for just having the lenses properly serviced as well. Now, that might cost a few hundred dollars or whatever currency you use. But if you have a lens that's, you know, $3,000 to replace, then it's well worth doing. It means you can keep that equipment that you're already familiar with, keep it active for a much longer time. And in my experience, I use my lenses are much older than my camera bodies. I've exchanged upgraded the camera bodies more often than I would the lens. Unfortunately, I'm at that point now with DSLR, whereas I think I kind of hit the peak on where DSLR bodies are. And if I upgrade it again to new equipment, it's going to be switching to mirrorless, just because that gear is generally much lighter. It's smaller and lighter, so a lot easier to carry. And the improvements in technology, things like tracking software and things like that on the cameras, all of that development is tending to happen on the mirrorless side. Now, DSLRs are, I think it's fair to say, winding down. Most of the major manufacturers who do pro level gear are maybe keeping existing equipment available, but all of their development is going into the mirrorless side. So if you haven't bought your gear yet and you're looking for something long term, that's what I would suggest. If you can find a system set up that works for you, so that's body and lenses that give you the kind of magnification that you want, then I would be inclined to go down that path, knowing that I'm likely to upgrade, change the body at some point. So it does lock you into a particular manufacturer at some state, unless you get independent lenses, of course. But as soon as you start putting adapters on them, you start to compromise how well they'll handle light, low light situations particularly. So that could be an issue given what I've discussed earlier. So there's lots to think about there, depending on where you're at. If you've already got all of your gear and you're quite happy with it and you shoot regularly, then there's probably not too much to think about. But I would definitely recommend having your gear serviced by a professional lab or workshop, just to make sure that everything is all good. And obviously then just check it all out before you go away and make sure that you know, maybe a month or so before you go away, have it all back just to be sure that everything is good and ready to go. Okay, so what else to think about on your wildlife trip? Obviously, the other things are more on the admin side. Just make sure that all your paperwork is up to date, your passport is good for wherever you're going, that you have the sort of 6 months validity on the passport beyond when you'll be leaving that country. If you're going into a wildlife park, often, certainly in some countries in Africa, I don't know about elsewhere, in fact, India too, at Kano, it was the same thing. You need to present identification, and you actually have to provide that identification as a reference when you book the trip. So that might be a scan of your photo page in the passport. When you turn up at the park, you need to have exactly the same document. So if you send a scan of a passport when you book the trip and then change your passport, get a new one because it's from the old one's running out, you may well find that they won't let you in because it's a different document. So that can create just some problems. So just be aware of that kind of thing. If you are doing that sort of a trip, whoever's organizing it for you locally should give you that guidance, let you know what is needed up front and what you need to bring with you. But if in doubt, just use that as a rule. Obviously, there's medication to think about. There might be local outbreaks of things, so just keep an eye on the government websites for travel recommendations, health recommendations. WHO is a good one for health. And obviously, unfortunately, there's a lot of unrest right now in the world. There's lots of nasty stuff going on, and certainly in some parts of the world. So obviously the Middle East is a big one right now as I'm recording this. But also in Africa, there's conflict. So Congo is still ongoing. So do check on your government website for travel recommendations, what they recommend for where you're either going or where you're thinking of going. And just keep an eye on them, because if it does start to go pear-shaped, you just want to be in touch with whoever you need to be in touch with, whether it's the tour operator, it might be whoever's organized your flights. And also look at your travel insurance when you go. Just make sure you are covered in case there is a conflict, or it might be a natural disaster, but something happens that prevents you from going. And also, if you're going somewhere a bit more remote, I would recommend that you make sure your insurance includes evacuation, because a lot of the standard insurances, if you're going somewhere off the beaten track, they won't cover you. If you're out in the bush somewhere and you get in trouble and you need to be evacuated, that can get very expensive very quickly. So you just need to make sure that you've got the right insurance. So again, whoever's organizing the trip for you, if you're not doing this yourself, most companies or reputable companies that I know that organize these trips will give you a recommendation for travel insurance. It would be a company they use regularly, and they have the right kind of cover for where you're going, so that if the worst happens, obviously you don't want that to happen, but you need to be prepared for it. They will get you out, and you won't find that you're suddenly in dire financial straits because of having to do an evacuation. Okay, so there's a few things to think about, and I guess just to recap, obviously research. Presumably you're going to a certain place for a reason. I would assume to see a particular animal, or hopefully to see one. So do all of your research about when they're likely to be there, just to make sure it does all sit well together. If you're going on an organized trip, one would expect that to all be thought out, but it's good to do what you can yourself to make sure you are happy that you're going to the right place at the right time. Think about how you want to use the photographs. So are you hoping to put them up on a wall somewhere? Are you going to put them on social media? Are you going to create a photo book? And I think one of the biggest shames with digital is that because we shoot so many photographs now, most of them just stay on their on someone's phone, on a hard drive somewhere, and they very rarely see the light of day again. And one of the things I recommend when you maybe are putting a selection of photos together for whatever reason is to maybe do it when you're traveling around, because if you've got Wi-Fi access, it's nice to just pop things up on social media so that friends and family can keep track of what you're doing and maybe be a part of the journey with you in that way. But then don't delete files. Keep them for a few months and then look at them again. And the reason is simply that when you've just taken a photograph, you've got an idea in your head of what you were hoping to get. And if what you did get doesn't quite match up with that idea, it can be quite disappointing. And the impulse is often to just delete it and have another go. But what I've seen myself, and I know other photographers recommend this, is when you look at an image several months down the line, and I'd say a minimum of 3 months, because by then you'll have forgotten what was in your mind when you took the shot, you're seeing that photograph in isolation. You're seeing it for what it is without any expectations around it. And some of my favorite photographs now are photographs that initially I might have deleted because they weren't what I had in my mind when I took them. I was going for something else and I got a different result. Taking that expectation away from the final result means that you can look at it as an image in its own right, and often you'll see it differently as well. So, and it's nice to periodically just run through all of your photographs. And if you're anything like me, you'll have thousands of them. But it's nice to just run through them. Then you'll suddenly see one that you've overlooked before, or maybe you saw and for whatever reason you didn't really have a good look at it. But when you look at it again, you really like it. So that's something I've experienced a lot. So I definitely recommend that. So that's thinking about how you're going to use the photographs. Another thing is to really know your camera. And I would say that if you look at an image, someone else's image, and you can't work out how they got it, you do need to just do a little bit of practice on your camera, maybe revisit some theory. Because once you can look at a photograph and understand how that shot was achieved, that means that your level of knowledge is at a stage where you can probably create pretty much anything that you want to. And one thing I didn't mention that I wanted to mention was that if you are looking for inspiration, there's lots of sources. So Instagram's a great one. And if you do a hashtag on wildlife photography or hashtag cheetahs or whatever, you'll see all sorts of work pop up by different photographers. And you might find one or two or three, whatever, photographers whose style you like. And by looking at their images, if you can work out how they achieved a certain shot, or some people do share the settings, although for me, the settings vary depending on the conditions. So they're a useful guide, but I don't take them any further than that. But you can work out how that shot was taken, and that in turn means that you can approach your trip, and when you start seeing the animals that you're seeing, you go there with some maybe a checklist of photographs you'd like to get. Whether or not you get them is something else, but you have some ideas ready to go and you know how to get those results. So that can be very helpful, and it means that when you're with that animal, you can enjoy being with them and also already know what kind of result you want to end up with. And that can be very satisfying after the trip to get something, to come back with some pictures that you were really hoping to get. Okay, so that I think is more or less it. Obviously, the documentation side, there's the medication side, vaccines. Yellow fever is a big one still. If you're going somewhere where yellow fever is an issue, and again, either whoever's organising the trip for you or your government website, I think WHO do it as well, World Health Organization. They'll tell you what vaccines are compulsory. So you have to show a vaccination certificate and what are recommended. So that would be up to you, depending on where you are, and maybe how far you are from being able to get help. And then obviously, as I've said, should the worst happen, make sure that your insurance will cover you. You may need to pay a little bit extra for the trip, but it means that you can, you do have that confidence that if the worst does happen, you can get out without having to, you know, end up in real serious trouble. So I hope you found that useful. And yeah, it's beginning of the year, new challenges, but new opportunities as well. And I hope that you're able to use this year to at least maybe meet some ambitions, go somewhere you've never been before, experience a cultures you've never experienced before, and get to see animals up close that perhaps you've never seen before, and get a new appreciation for them and the environment that they're in, and the people who share that environment with them. So that's it for now. I will speak to you on the next podcast. Bye for now. Just before I go, I want to let you know that there's a couple of ways you can support me if you feel so inclined. With the podcast, Buzzsprout, which is the platform I use for all of my podcasts, they have a subscription model. So if you feel that you would like to subscribe a few dollars, a few euros, whatever, to the podcast, that'd be much appreciated. The other option is my Patreon membership. So if you'd like to become a patron, and that starts at the price of a cup of coffee every month, you'll get access to exclusive material, behind-the-scenes material, photography tips, all this kind of stuff, depending on which tier you're at. So there is information available through my website and also on the written text to go with this podcast. So if you choose either one, thank you so much in advance. And whether or not you do, I hope you continue to enjoy the podcast and let other people know about them. Thank you very much. Bye for now.